Welcome to Collection Chronicles, the podcast that brings the world of collections. What are you laughing at?
I'm not laughing at you.
Tanya's laughing at me. You're not laughing.
Go ahead, go.
So the podcast that brings the world of collections closer to you, as you know. Unfortunately, today, Carly is not here because she is in Orlando.
No.
Aren't we jealous?
Very much so.
Very much. So with us today is Tanya.
Hi. Keeping it simple this time.
Perfect. And I want to introduce to the listeners, Chris Seepy. Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon. Or evening, depending almost on when you're listening to this, I suppose.
Yep. You're right. So Chris Seepy is the published author of Landlording in Ontario. Chris teaches a 36-hour highly immersive landlording in Ontario course, and he is the founder and president of the Landlords Association of Durham, and he's also a commercial real estate broker of record at Aztec Realty in Toronto. Chris, I just wanted to ask you, I've heard a lot of things that you do in your life. You're kind of like a, what do you call it, somebody that's versed in everything.
Last of the Renaissance men.
Yeah, Renaissance men. Like he's like a Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah, a Renaissance man. Like,
is that a polyman?
Master of all?
Without the brain, no.
Well, you need some.
You need a little bit. I suppose.
So, Chris, I would like to ask you, and for so that the listeners understand, how did you start this whole thing? I know you have investments, you're a landlord, but how did this whole landlording course and all that come about?
Well, I guess I was in the computer business for about 35 years, and it dawned on me one day, about a decade ago, that I would not be able to retire in the life to which I would like to become accustomed to, right?
And what is that life like?
Well, I haven't gotten there yet, but when I do, I'll know I've arrived. But I realize, like many professionals, doctors, dentists, lawyers, surveyors, it doesn't matter. They don't have any time retirement, and in the computer business, you don't have that either. Mm-hmm. So after many months, decided that real estate was the one investment opportunity I felt gave the best potential for retirement income. And I'm looking for an annuity stream, something that would go on forever. And
very smart.
You know, I'd heard for a long time that you could use other people's money, and I always thought that was realtor, hogwash, if you will. Yeah. And I never really gave it much thought, but this time the light went on and I said, oh, I put down 25%, but I can own 100% of something, then that might make sense. Mm. And then the next question was, okay, what kind of real estate? Do I do office, residential, retail, industrial?
Right. I mean, that's
yeah,
a big
special purpose, right? I mean, do I, with my background, maybe I should have opened up a data center, data processing center or something like that, right? But I decided that multi-residential, to me, is the safest, most secure. Not that it's secure, but it's the most secure of any of the types of real estate investing that you could do. So I made that decision. I took the investment from the a line of credit on my home, and I went and bought my first property. That would have been in 2011, which
is nice and risky.
8 years ago.
It's a good time to buy, actually.
Well, even then, I had there were five competing offers for the property.
Really?
And that was in 2011.
That's crazy.
And I had to win out against those other four to do it. But seven buildings later in 8 years, so I'm doing okay.
That's
turned out okay.
That speaks for itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, I know I sold a house before, but never invested. But I know, Tanya, you did, right?
We had it rented first. It sort of wasn't, it was an initial investment, like a family home. But through some circumstances, it was left to me and my sisters. And we rented it out instead of selling it, which was good. It paid for itself. But of course, you get into trouble with some renters, and they trash the whole place. So,
but not unheard of.
Yeah,
so you got a bad taste in your mouth.
Yeah, so we put some money into it to get it marketable to sell. We could have sold it as is, but we would have lost a lot on the sale, or we could have just, in the hype of sales and home sales being people coming from Toronto and buying up in Hamilton, we probably could have got a pretty good amount of money, but mm-hmm. it was worth it to put the money into it to get the higher value, mm-hmm. and sold it for a good return.
Good for you.
So yeah, it put a bad taste in my mouth. It wasn't the first time in my history renting, because like before when I was younger, remember I told you, so I ended up going for bankruptcy. I invested in a property. And it ended up foreclosing, but
hey,
whatever.
That's the past.
Yeah. But that's what was my initial mindset. Shitty renters again.
But you know,
but it doesn't dissuade me. You learn from it, and there's a lot of things I learned from the first time that I corrected the second time, and I still ended up getting a little bit messed up. But at least I had those protections in there, where there was a lease, there was a means to get rid of them, and get some kind of return, where it wasn't a complete total loss.
So then, basically, what it is you've had some sort of self education and understanding
every time,
and that's exactly where Chris comes in, because. Chris, and correct me if I'm wrong, what Chris says is that a lot of these landlords that start up, mm-hmm. as, you know, okay, I want to be a landlord, they think it's, you know, all full of honey and it's,
well,
it's
an easy
job.
Well, they think it's passive income.
Yeah,
right?
It's not passive.
Collect the money every month and then fix a toilet once a year.
So what is it really?
Well, it's anything but that. I mean, if you hire somebody, you know, like a property manager, but property managers take most of the profit. You know, they'll take anywhere from 5 to 10% of the gross income, mm-hmm. and that can represent 50% or more of the bottom line profit.
And sometimes, you know, first month's rent too, right?
And they, on top of that, will charge individual fees for finding tenants, for going to the LTB, for managing special projects. If you've got to swap out a boiler, for example, they've got to manage that. They want to be paid extra for all of that.
Right,
mm-hmm. and that's super expensive. I'm still not doing it. I have 81 units, and I still manage hands-on by myself.
Oh my God!
I couldn't imagine.
Yeah,
it was hard enough. Just I was checking in every couple of months. The first property I lived in, and that was hard because you see them all the time, and it creates this weird animosity. Because mm-hmm. you're trying to make sure you're protecting your interests, but they don't care. And then the second time is I wasn't there, which made it even tougher because I would just get. Lip service, and then and I come back, and nothing I'd asked.
I would never give you lip service. Like, well, I'd be like, no.
No, like, well, that's the thing, right? They just, you know, try to, oh yeah, no worries, and then I come back, and I'm like, what the hell is this?
Well, residential tenancy law in Ontario is extremely pro-tenant, mm-hmm. and I can guarantee to you that if you do not know Tenancy law. I guarantee to you, sooner or later in your investment career, you will become a victim of it.
Yeah.
In a material way, either financially or legally.
And this is what you're teaching in your landlording course. So
that's right.
So tell us a little bit about what kind of things people are not prepared for and that you teach them in this, what is it, it's 36 hours, right?
It's a 36-hour course. I broke it up into two parts. The first half is how do you find these properties? Because there's a huge demand, huge... number of people that are looking for these properties are highly desirable investment properties, they believe. So where do you find them? How do you decide what the value of that property is? Because mm-hmm. I can tell you a lot of people overpay for these things. And, as long as interest rates stay down at 2 or 3%, you're okay. But if the interest rates double, you can lose your whole investment for sure. So the first half of the course is how do you find them? How do you decide how much these properties are worth? But most importantly, you're never going to be able to buy these properties at fair market value. Because the demand is so high, you'll always overpay. Every single property I've ever bought, I've overpaid anywhere from $50,000 to $150,000 more than I should have.
Really?
Yeah. In order to
The market's inflated a little bit. Yeah.
So that's the first half. And the second half is now that you've got the property, how do you deal with the tenants? How do you deal with arrears? As an example, because of the really arcane and difficult processes that the landlord and tenant board puts you through, or the LTB, it can take anywhere from 4 to 6 months for an eviction or to get a judgment for damages and so on. Mm-hmm. So I have a policy, which I make very clear in the letter that I give to tenants, that if I don't see the money on the first, I will contact you on the second by email, text, phone, whatever I can. And if I don't hear from you within 24 hours, and on the third, I issue an N-4. And an M4 is a notice of rent arrears, and that you must
pay up.
You must pay up, or you'll be evicted.
Get out.
Yeah.
Right.
So they take exception to that, and I have to explain why. It's not me; it's the LTB. Because without the N4, I have a very difficult time proving any kind of a case for rent arrears.
Absolutely.
Or consistent,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And N4s, we see them in our collection files all the time.
Yeah.
I mean,
and it's a staple of being able to collect.
You have to. And in Ontario, it's an N4, right?
Right. Yes, I mean, that's right.
Different
provinces
or states, it's a different.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But basically, it's a notice to pay up or move out.
Well, 90% of tenancy law in Canada is at the provincial level. It's handled by the province, not by. It's not federal, and it's not municipal. Bylaws are municipal, but tenancy law is provincial.
Provincial, yeah. And that's what the LTB here does, right? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And or the ORT or whatever the other bodies are.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm interested in, when did the break come for you where you said, oh my God, this is so crazy, I got to teach this? Like, how did that come about?
Well, I started up the Landlord Association of Durham and did that 2012 or 2013, around there. And I kept on getting the same questions over and over and over again. And I would ask myself, how can you spend $500,000 to buy a property and not know that you can't change the locks? And then they get into serious trouble, or they turn off the electricity because they didn't pay for it, so I'm going to turn it off. Well, no, you can't do those things. And it became obvious to me that there was no venue. There's really no place to go and learn this stuff. The dark side.
Mm-hmm.
If you talk to real estate pundits and gurus, they'll tell you all the wonderful things about creating asset wealth in a year and how you can buy 10 buildings with 10% down, which is, of course, nonsense as well. So I had all these neophyte landlords asking the same types of questions, and they don't realize the extent of the legal jeopardy that they're putting themselves in. So I said I'd start teaching a course. And originally it was going to be 42 hours because that's the amount of time I thought you needed in order to get a good understanding of the exposures. But nobody would commit to that time. So it wound up being
condensed.
Six Saturdays. Basically, I broke it up in two of 6 hours
each.
That's
fair, I think.
Yeah, that's not bad.
But I still maintain that if you're going to spend $500,000 buying a property or any amount of money, it could be millions.
Should be educated.
You might want to invest in a six Saturday course to, out of the hundreds that I've taught, I've only had two people come back and say it was the best course I ever took, and there's no way on this earth I will ever become a landlord.
I like that.
They didn't want to go through all the trouble of it.
Well, they realize that there's a whole different perception that
the
pundits and gurus do not tell you about. Right?
Well, true.
Frankly, I mean, people were asking us as the collection agency all the time, why don't you open up a landlord or a property management firm? And my answer is always, we know what it takes because we see it. We see all the collections. You think we're going to open one up? No. We know not to.
It's
not for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
I mean, you can make a living. The payoff isn't in the cash flow, contrary to what people say. The cash flow is not as compelling as people think it is.
It's a long-term investment in yourself, the equity that's built, and the leveraging of the credit that's built up.
From so either you sell it or refinance.
Yeah.
So if you refinance, you can, and that's what I did. I've refinanced every property. That's how I've gotten
to
seven.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's where the payoff is. So you're creating asset wealth, but I'm still living in the same house, nothing special. I haven't changed my lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, when you sell them off,
it's like a retirement thing. You're leveraging your credit to build and you can sell off those properties and say, forget it, I'm going to sell everything.
That's
where the return comes and it gives you that retirement.
Unless you get to the point by that time where you've got enough so that it does have a revenue stream, but at that point,
carries the property manager. But in my experience, you really need about 100 units that you own personally.
No, he's got more than that. Oh, yeah, he's got 82 units, right?
Well,
so he's got...
Yeah.
I mean, okay.
But so that's what I mean. Like, you own your own building, and it's like you have like all these
with
units.
With no financing. I think you need to have 100. Yes. I think you need to own 100 units with no financing in order to be able to pay for staff to take care of it, and then you can enjoy the life that you thought you were going to have when you bought the building before you had the 100 units.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting because when we talked on the phone originally, I mentioned to you that I keep telling people that over the years of seeing landlord collections and landlords, you know, we meet CEOs and PMs all the time. And what I've boiled it down to is if you're a large, large property management firm, you've got economies of scale, and you can, you know, there's financing there, there's money there, so you're good. If you have, on the other end of it, you've got one unit like Tanya, like you did, you can still make money because maybe you'll sell the unit or you'll just have your mortgage paid for, kind of stuff.
Well, it's not even that. The thing that the high end and the low end both share is that they can pass on all of their operational costs to the tenant.
Yeah. Right.
So with a single family home, they pay for the electricity, the gas, the heat, the water, and everything, right? You pass that on. On the high end, you've got the economies of scale, and sometimes with suite metering, you can also do the same thing, pass on all those costs. Right. Yeah. You've got the economies of scale.
But what we were saying is, and this was interesting because when I said it, you said, exactly, that's what my book is about.
Yeah.
Right.
What my thing boiled down to is, in the middle, from the 1 to 1,000 units, like you either become a slum landlord because to make the equation work, you're not going to renovate.
Right.
No, you never put no money in,
or you're not going to make it. But you have a way of making it, right?
That's right. They refer to that, and it's not one, but it's typically a threeplex to a 40-plex.
Yeah,
typically,
yeah.
That group they refer to as the missing middle, because there were literally tens of thousands of units built before 1972 when rent controls came in.
Mm-hmm.
They were building in the order of 30,000 to 40,000 a year.
Okay.
Of rental units. And then rent controls came in, and it dropped down to 400 or 500 a year.
Wow! Mm.
And those units were in the form of triplexes, quads, 12-plexes, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there were literally thousands of those buildings built in the 50s and 60s, up until, you know, like I say, the end of the '60s. All of those, they stopped building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all of the purpose-built rental properties were replaced by condos by 1980. Only condos were being built. And then individual investors rent those things out.
Yeah.
Well, missing middle purpose-built properties rent a lot cheaper than condos do.
Yes.
Condos are not affordable housing.
No, they're not. No.
So that's why they call it the missing middle, because nobody has built these affordable missing fourplexes to 40-plexes. That's all, you know. All of that inventory, 87% of the total purpose-built inventory in Ontario was built before 1980. Nine out of 10 buildings.
Wow.
So, and there was no building code in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Building code came out in 1972, I think, and it was around 1975 that the municipality started to adopt that.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these old buildings have plaster walls with 2 inches of foam core, and then
knob and
the brick
tube
wall.
Electricity,
Well, not so much knob and tube now, but I mean, you'll find that in homes. I don't think you find that in
apartment buildings
now so much.
Well, okay. I was talking to somebody. He bought a house in his first house, 1990s or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
He said the house still had a GM fridge, General Motors, Electric, Motors.
So it was like a really old property.
Yeah.
Well, not really old, but like,
he had to gut the whole unit.
Yeah, I mean,
the whole building.
Yeah,
I wasn't even aware of that.
No.
General
made
Motors made a.
I know Mitsubishi makes like TVs and stuff.
Oh sure,
yeah.
the Japanese conglomerates.
Yeah,
Samsung used to be. My kids told me Samsung used to be a boat menu. Like they made fishing boats.
Oh, I don't even know that one.
In any case, so that's what the missing middle is, and the problem with the missing middle is that it takes the brunt of all of these laws that are passed, such as electricity can't be passed on anymore. The property taxes and the above guideline increases now take over a year. I'm still waiting for two AGIs that had filed last November, and we haven't even got a hearing date for them yet.
Yeah, and AGIs are pretty difficult. Well, it's not difficult, but they...
What is an AGI?
It's an above the guideline rent increase.
Okay.
Some call it AGI. It's AGI, but...
So if there's an abnormal... increase in at cost.
Okay.
Typically utilities or property taxes.
Right, right.
But also if you've invested to replace a boiler for $20,000,
oh,
you can recover some of that money back in the form of increasing the rent. But the law only allows for a maximum of 9% of that money to be recovered, 9% of the income. So if you've got a property that's generating $100,000 a year in income, which is typical of, a templex, a boiler would cost you between $15,000 and $20,000. The most that you can get back is $9,000.
For that boiler. So
for
you're
that
still,
boiler.
You're
so
still
you're
out.
Still out. And on top of that, you can only collect 3% per year for 3 years.
Yep. So, you're
so
still
you can't
out.
Get the 9,000. You can only get 3,000 in the first year. And then half of the tenants move out.
Then
and you can't collect from any of them because the law assumes that the new tenant who's moved in, you've already accounted for that in the adjustment to market rent.
Mm. Well, you would think with all these pro-tenant decisions by the board and by the landlord-tenant board and all these laws that have changed, you would think that us as a collection agency would not see that many tenants in collections. But it's almost like it's increased double or threefold.
Yeah.
And what do you have to say to that? So do you see a lot of tenants that go delinquent for one reason or another? Do you have any experience with that?
In fact, I asked this question of a couple of people at the last Landlord Association meeting. I said, I'm experiencing a much more
higher turnover rate.
Well, I'm finding that tenants becoming much more aggressive and they're emboldened.
Ah, yes.
And they're willing to take you to task on the most trivial things, and they don't hesitate to use things like or phrases like "I know my rights," and "I'm going to have my lawyer contact you."
Oh yeah, we hear that a lot.
Yeah.
So we
of
do.
You guys would.
Yeah.
But landlords, I never used to have that level of conflict, let's call it.
Yeah.
And I asked others, and a couple said, no, I haven't really seen that. And then as they started to ask their peers, they said, yes, we are seeing that there is a lot more. And their prevailing theories, one of them is that the media, of course, is being much more aggressive about the stories, or even sensationalistic about the stories that they present of the evil, dirty, grubby
landlord. Slumlord.
But the other thing I think is happening is that because of the housing crisis and the unavailability of houses, with the stress test that came in, 200,000 Canadians were locked out of the ability to buy a home.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So because of that increased stress test, those 200,000 people would normally have moved out of the rental market into those homes. They can't, so they've pushed back.
Right.
So they're staying longer. So the people who are behind them that would move in, whether it's students, immigrants, refugees, or even people who are trying to get from a subsidized housing into regular housing and improve their lifestyle, all of those people are being held back. So there's this cascading effect. And what's happening, I believe, is that there's a sense of entrapment and frustration that they can't move.
Yeah.
And because they can't move, it's the landlord's fault. And they know.
The rent's too damn high.
Intellectually. Well, that's the other problem is that they say those damn greedy landlords have increased the rent. You know, it used to be $950 and I should be able to move from one place to another. But now it's, instead of 900, it's 1,200.
Yeah.
But in fact, what happened, which there were a number of conferences on this. In fact, what I hear happen is, because they had all this rent control, so landlords that would have had like high rent, medium rent, and low rent, they've decided because they can't up on the left side of it, they'll just up all of them a little bit. So who lost out? It's the tenant that cannot pay the lower rent because all the rents were raised up to the max level.
Yeah.
Right. So there's some of that too, I'm sure. But the other challenge that a tenant faces, and this is what makes them angry for sure, is that when they think that they're going to go out there and that there are 20 places to look for.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
You know, and now they're finding out that there's 20 tenants that are looking for that one unit.
Yep, right.
I get on average about 40 or 50 inquiries per vacancy and probably 5 or 6 applications. So I will not take a marginal tenant, period.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
I would much rather have a vacant unit and lose $1,500 in rent than take on a marginal tenant where I'm going to lose between $5,000 and $6,000.
Yep.
If they turn out to be not a collection client of yours.
Yeah. Right. Right. And yeah,
in fact, do you have any kind of an average on what a collection arrear might be?
Well, I would say the average that we see is usually a month, month and a half of rent or so, depending on the landlord.
And is that so because they're being proactive right away, right? Your landlord client.
Probably. I mean, not all of them are proactive, but I would say that usually it's an issue of not giving proper notice. And usually it's a time frame that's basically prescribed by law, you know, the 2 months and the 60 days and all of that. So you obviously are not going to hold somebody responsible for 10 months of rent because you didn't re-rent the unit.
Yeah.
Some people try that, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah,
no one's going to pay you 10 months of rent.
Yeah.
Well, the Federation of Rental Property Owners of Ontario, FRPO, says that the average loss at the LPO, LTB, pardon me, is $5,200.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds right.
Average.
Yeah.
I mean, I have some files on there that's like $10,000 on rent. And I'm like, well, how did
you get
there?
We've noticed in the last couple of years, the average rent, that if we're looking at clients that we collect for rent, because we collect on other types of debts. But you're looking at going from like $1,500 to extravagant, like $9,000 rents.
Yeah.
And like, how do you collect it? Who's going to pay that?
No.
Yeah. Well, that's for me, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not sure that this is what a collection agency wants to hear necessarily, but for me, collection is my last recourse. Mm-hmm. I will do anything I can to try and mitigate that loss, work something out with the tenant. I've only ever been to the LTB in the 10 years I've been doing this. I've only been to the LTB twice, and once went to a hearing. The other one was mediation. Both times I won.
Yeah.
But they put me in that position. They escalated it to, you know, but I walk away from money all the time. And one of the things I'll do, so I think of collections as found money.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was getting at, is I've already written off the $4,000, and if you guys can collect some of it back, we all win.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
So that's why I say whatever you can get, you know, that's fine by me. Mm. But with respect to these tenants, I will do anything that I can to make a deal. And sometimes they'll owe me a month's rent. What I'm more inclined to do is say, look, I can't, I could take you to collections. I could wreck your credit score. I could, there are those options. But instead of paying me the last month's rent that you owe, when you move out, let's sign an N-11, which says that you agree to move out on this date. I agree to let you go. I will not ask you for your last month's rent, but you clean the fridge, you clean the stove, you clean the bathtub. Don't leave any garbage behind.
Yep.
Get rid of all your furniture. Take it with you. Mm-hmm. If you got stuff that you don't want to take it and dump it at your new place.
Yeah.
Don't leave it here.
Yeah.
You're putting it on the next landlord.
Well, that's what I did at my house. I was like, just take the garbage with you and we'll like not charge you for all the damage and stuff.
That's right.
Just like, just get out of
here. That's right.
Yeah.
So you make a deal with them and, it only costs $30 for them to take to the garbage dump, but they're lazy.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a question of cost so much as it's inconvenience.
And some of them are bitter too and petty and they just do it out of spite.
And that's why, if they know that they're going to have an upside of 1 month's rent, then you turn the whole thing around.
Yeah.
Now they want to show the unit. Now they're going to keep the unit clean when you bring in new tenants to look at them.
Yeah.
And part of the deal is they can't talk to the new guys.
Yeah.
When somebody comes in, they step out or they move into a different room or whatever. We do the 5-minute tour. The tenants leave and then
they can come back.
Then they can come back in.
For
exactly.
The showings.
Sounds like a
for the showings.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what I try to do. And I'm successful in many cases, but I'm finding now that it's becoming increasingly
more difficult.
Well, they're raising the bar. The tenants are raising the bar, and I have to push back, you know, or I'm going to get killed.
Yeah,
financially.
Well, it's true. But I also want to concur with you because a lot of times when we have smaller landlords that call in, they would say, "Okay, what do I do?" My first advice that I give to them, as opposed to, you know, come with us, we'll collect for you, we'll make money on you.
Yeah.
The first thing that I say and our sales team says is, well, did you try negotiating with them? Because you could do that even settle it for the amount of commission that we would charge you. So take that off the top, because why list it with us when you can just settle it right now and get them gone?
Sure.
Because the problem with a bad tenancy is the opportunity cost that you're still in the unit. You're not re-renting. That's the problem.
That's
get them out, even if you have a loss, and just cut your losses and move forward. Right.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
Yeah, and you're not going to recover the money in most cases, no matter what it is.
It's true.
You know, for me, collections are more about getting a notice put onto their credit history, for example, so that their next tenancy is going to be a much more difficult thing for them to find, and they won't they won't get that until they try to get a phone plan.
Yeah.
Or when they move into the next apartment, they phone up the electricity company and say, ah, you got a lousy credit score. We're charging you $300 a deposit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the gas company says that, and the phone company says that, and the credit card, you know, and so on. And it perpetuates. And all of a sudden, their bad behavior, let's call it,
right,
has caught up with them.
It's impacting their credit.
Right.
Now, because we're running out of time, I got a question for you, which, you know, we always post to everybody on the podcast because it's called Collection Chronicles.
what's your chronicle?
Well, I've only had one before I met you guys where I went and took a tenant who had been living there for a couple of years, and then his father needed to be taken care of, and you know, you call it divine intervention or whatever, but the unit next to this fellow's unit became available, so it was absolutely perfect for him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he had his father move in next door, and he signed as a guarantor.
For the father?
For the father. Mm-hmm. Then the father had to move maybe a year later to a nursing home, and the tenant said, you know, I'm not responsible for my father's debt. And I said, well, wait a minute.
You are.
You are. And eventually I did take that to the to a collection agency because he just he ignored me. Mm-hmm. And it's not that it was a big deal. It was $800 to $1,000. I mean, you know, that matters, but it's, you know.
Yeah,
really,
it wasn't
small.
It's
wasn't
not a consequential thing,
it wasn't
enough to lose sleep on.
Yeah.
But it just irked me to no end that he felt that he would just walk away from his obligations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And especially since he's still a tenant.
Yeah.
So in this particular case, I turned it over to a collection agency, and it was after he got the letter from the collection agency that he called me up, and then I settled. But I still had to pay the collection agency at that point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But that was, you know, and it still took a year and a half for him to pay back. He paid back, you know, $100 or $50 a month, something like that. But he paid it, and I never begrudged that, you know. He did step up when he was called on his obligations to do that. That's
actually a good story, because I think there's some positive in that too, because a lot of people do come around with their obligations and they have to be pushed. You're right. But, you know, I still think, you know, I would be okay with that. If you do that, that's fine. As long as you come around and say, okay, you know what, I was wrong and I have to do it. No matter that it's a collection agency or a paralegal or whoever that's true. Right?
That's exactly right. And the other thing I'll do is, and I've done this many times, is I'll tell a tenant, if you're not going to call me, you're not going to call me back, I'm turning this over your account to a collection agency. Mm-hmm. They would not know the law and the process that one has to go through. And frankly, I might be inclined not to even bother going to the LTB. I would just turn it over to collection and say, hey, can you guys do something with this?
And
you guys decide whether or not you want to take it on. Because for me, again, it's lost money. They're gone, and I've rented it out. So, you know, it's yours if you want it.
Well, all this advice you can actually hear at your landlord's course, right?
Yeah.
I'm assuming. So what I would like to see is if you could give our listeners a little bit of information on where they can find your course, how they can sign up, and
so the course is, I only teach twice a year, and I keep it to a maximum of 18 students per
session?
Class because of the interactivity of it. That is 6 Saturdays. The next one actually starts in 2 days from this podcast.
Is it full already?
Which is the 21st of,
Is it full?
No, it's not full yet. I'm astonished.
I want to go.
There are people that are will sign up the day before, and I've even had people that sign up who've missed the first class, and they wow. take the next five. I have a policy of if you miss a class, you can always pick it up on the next class, and I have people that do that all the time.
Yeah.
So you would go to www.landlording, with an ing, landlording course, not C-O-A, C-O-U-R.
The correct spelling.
Yes. Landlordingcourse.ca.
Yeah.
I've written a book called Landlording Ontario, which is a superset of what that course is about. It's the only book, and I say this with sincerity, not to self-promote. It's the only book that I'm aware of that speaks to the true issues of being a landlord. And that's on landlordingbook.com.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a video. But you would find that I've recorded one of my class sessions.
Okay. So on YouTube.
So I would no. It's 18 DVDs. If you try to put them onto a DVDs, that's it's 36 hours.
Jeez.
Your average movie is 2 hours, and it fills a DVD, right?
Right.
So 36 would be 18 discs.
Yeah.
No, I load it up on a hard drive.
Okay.
So what's the next book you're working on? What's the title of that one?
Yeah, well,
I'm almost finished.
3/4, I would say. It's called The Dark Side of Residential Landlording. And the reason I've written that book is because of the significant changes in law, especially in the last couple of years, have been so persecutorial.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like the government is deliberately targeting the landlord. And it's not just landlords, the lenders, it's the bylaws. There's a whole slew of human rights code. As far as I'm concerned, there are things that they've targeted landlords for, I think, unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
So the book is all about all the things that could hit you from the most unexpected sources.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it will be obvious, like tenants. But I have a case of the lost stove, not the stolen stove. The missing, the lost stove.
Wow.
That sounds like an interesting chronicle.
Yeah.
So,
we got a couple of minutes. Tell
all right,
that one.
So here's a 30-second version of that.
Yeah.
So the tenant moves in. Unbeknownst to me, they bring their own stove. They didn't tell me this. They didn't put it into the lease. They just bring their own stove. And then on their own volition, without discussion, they put their perfectly good stove that I gave them into the basement. Well, at some point, I had decided that there was a fridge and two stoves and an air conditioner and some other stuff that didn't belong there. And I sent a letter to everyone saying, I'm going to be turning this over to a metal recycling company. They're going to come and pick up this stuff. If any of this stuff is yours, please take it away. And if there's any reason I shouldn't move this, please tell me. Well, they didn't. They got the letter. They told me about it. And then maybe a month or so later, after the metal collector had come, they told me that their stove wasn't working and they needed a new one. And I said, well, mm-hmm. Where's mine? Well, it's in the basement. But I told you that I was moving all that stuff to a recycling. Oh, yeah, we got the letter, but I forgot. And I said,
you don't get a stove. But
well,
I guess
that's
you
exactly
can't. Yeah.
What happened. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm not replacing your stove. He says, well, I'll see you in the LTB. And I said, great. I think you're going to have a really hard time with that.
Yeah.
And he said, then my lawyer will be calling. And I said,
okay.
That's good too, because you may not realize it, but I do know the law, and I will educate your lawyer as well.
Yeah.
And of course, they didn't.
They didn't do anything.
That's a little bit arrogant,
yeah.
But that's the. But it's true.
You
many,
have to say that to them, yeah.
Well, it's not just to them, but many lawyers do not practice Tennessee law. They don't know this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I
they
think
just know
I know
they have to defend their client.
Yeah.
But they have to defend, and they're not going to tell them that they don't know this stuff.
Yeah,
right?
No, they'll take
so,
the money.
So anyway, he says, I don't know why you get upset. You know, you can get a new, you can get a used stove for $150. And I said, okay, so here's what I'm willing to do. I will give you $200. You go find your stove, replace it, but you have to take the one that you've got to the garbage. So I will give you $200. I will write you, you just find it, you give me the bill, and I'll reimburse it. Here it is in an email. And I never heard from him again.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, that's the case of the Lost Stove.
Interesting.
Right? I love that one. Right. That should have been your chronicle. Perfect. But you know what? We got two chronicles in one show.
Well, there you go. So that's what the book is about. It's stories like that and things that you would absolutely be dumbfounded to learn. It's just astounding. Some of the things that you would think would be obvious are anything but.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, so,
some interesting people in the world.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. I like that one.
I like that one too.
It's a bit irreverent in places, but I think I need to do that to hold the attention. Otherwise, it gets a little bit boring.
Well, that's fine. And we know that you have different literary accomplishments, but I'm not going to even go into that. We talked about them.
That'll be for the free for all.
listeners can actually look that up. But our last little bit is. You've said where they can reach you. Is there a phone number or email?
Yeah, so the email, so my name is Chris Seepy, and it's first initial, last name, C-S-E-E-P-E at Aztec, A-Z-T-E-C-H, Realty, R-E-A-L-T-Y. Some people put an I in there. Aztec Realty, you know, it's not.
Aztec Realty.
AztecRealty.com. Or 416-525-1558. And I'm happy to answer questions. If it gets too long, I'll tell you it gets too long.
Wonderful. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay. And as always?
Pay or get played.
Thank you.
Oh, and if you have any questions or comments, you can email us at gbpodcasts@gobeyondcollect.com. We're done.
That was good.
Money, 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 money.